Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
With us today is Steve Gordon. Steve is a Pluralsight author, Microsoft MVP, senior developer, and community lead based in Brighton, UK. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Steve, before we get started and try to jump into the meat of the podcast, would you just give us a little bit of an introduction to yourself and maybe sort of tell us about how you got started in the industry?
Sure. So I was thinking about this answer actually earlier on, and I was thinking it's been 19 or 20 years now since I've been in the tech industry in general. I didn't start out as a developer. My first sort of roles in tech were around desktop PC support. And then that moved naturally into sort of servers and networking. And I found that I was kind of interested in development. So I was messing around with things like QuickBasic, I think, VB6 probably at the time, and just sort of playing around and finding my feet in development. And then that hobby sort of grew a little bit more. And in one of my sort of next jobs, I found that I didn't have enough desktop work to be doing. So I sort of said, oh, we need an intranet. And, oh, why don't we make this an application? So started playing around with, I think at the time we were using sort of Access and VBA and some classic ASP in there as well. And then kept sort of moving through, I think hit VB.net around .NET 1.0. And then started to realize that it was easier to learn C# than to keep sort of transcoding the samples I was finding online in C# into VB. So sort of took that move. And then about 4 years ago, I was actually in a management role at that stage, managing desktop support and server support for a large customer of ours. And I found it quite stressful. I wasn't really enjoying the job. I was taking more and more side projects on for customers, doing sort of little ASP.NET web applications, things like that, and decided actually I enjoy this as a day job, and then sort of switched careers about 4 years ago full time into a developer role at Magix there. And you can't stop me now.
Very cool. So what are you doing there? What sort of like are you focused on there?
So for the last 2 or 3 years, I've been building out, a couple of us have been building out a project which we've called Insights, which is a sort of analytics and reporting suite that that sort of bolts onto data that we're streaming out of our product. So our main product is digital job boards, basically. We've sort of got sort of hundreds of customers running one of two variants of our sort of job board technology. We had sort of basic analytics in those platforms, but we wanted to really kind of step up the game and do a lot more around real-time insights and things. So we built an event stream out of those platforms and built a sequence of microservices really to process that data and eventually store it down into Elasticsearch. And then we built a sort of a set of APIs for querying over the top of that. So that's taken up the last 2 or 3 years, and now we're in a break the monolith phase with the actual existing products. So we're starting to take all of that learning of what we've done with those microservices and try and slice chunks off of the existing products so we can actually kind of really start to iterate on that more quickly as well.
And you do a fair amount of writing and blogging as well. I know that I came across your writing a year or two ago and really enjoyed a lot of the things I was reading. It seems like you're really focusing and learning and digesting and writing about the latest and greatest technologies that are coming out.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you found those and found them enjoyable. I think it timed kind of well with that project kicking off. Really, we were building that around the .NET Core birth. Really, of we were actually in the RC1 phase when we started putting the first few bits into production, which did bite us a little with the changes they made between RCs and the final release, but that's all behind us now. We're all friends again. But because we were kind of some of the first people to be using that tech in production. It meant there was a lot of things that when I was trying to find out how to do them, I just couldn't find the articles or the information. So I thought, well, I'll give blogging like the fifth attempt over the years I've tried blogging with sort of varying degrees of consistency. But with this new sort of area to explore, I just went around trying to solve problems and put them down onto the blog. And yeah, it's reasonably consistent now. I try and do something every 1 or 2 weeks, hopefully sort of content that just either isn't out there or is a sort of fresh take on something. And for me, I find that a really good way to take what I've been learning and kind of bed it into my mind. I've not got the best of memories, but if I write it down, some of it sort of sticks. And if it doesn't, I can usually Google for myself and find it later on.
So you mentioned breaking apart the monolith. What's sort of the approach that you have had to take to kind of do that successfully?
So we're in sort of early phases, and the way we've tackled it is we've split what was the original sort of platform support team into multiple groups, really, and each have kind of taken a few specific slices of what the existing application does. So we've got a team that's dealing with job details display, which was obviously one of the key pages on the existing site, is being able to get good job information up on the screen, making it clear for people to work their way around that page and eventually apply for jobs through the job board platform. So that was sort of one slice that the team are tackling. There's another team that's working around some of the user data and user management pieces that are on the back end. So we've kind of taken some distinct slices that we feel we can break apart. And we're at the moment now sort of testing the initial phases of that work. We're in AWS, so we're just using CloudFront to route some of the certain paths off to those new applications, slowly building the traffic up. And it's definitely a learning curve for everyone involved. My side of it is more around what we're calling the core services. So as we break that stuff apart, all of our nice analytics code needs to be slightly reconsidered, because when everything was in a single process, the world was quite straightforward. Now we have to manage this sort of concept of an analytics session, you know, someone viewing different jobs around the site across multiple services. So we've sort of been working on the underpinnings of that platform. Configuration also becomes a whole new challenge when you need different people picking up different configuration from what was the old XML-based system into now a more centralized API store for that. And just sort of taking those small chunks really as our first phase, laying the groundwork hopefully for slicing off more and more chunks until eventually we've kind of swallowed what was the monolith into a series of microservices.
Have you had any particular challenges in breaking apart the monolith in inter-process communication between the microservices, or how do you deal with the flow of what the existing monolith may have had?
So that has been probably a very big learning curve in terms of, again, when you've got everything in process, calling methods across all of your different parts of your application becomes really straightforward. And as we started to shift into these individual services, some of them are APIs, some of them are sort of data processing pipelines, we've had to reconsider what it means to communicate between those items. So what was a method call could potentially become a HTTP call. But what we try to do is avoid that kind of coupling wherever we can, because if you end up with tens, even hundreds of microservices that are now all chatting over HTTP, you've really just built what's sort of commonly referred to now as a distributed monolith. And that doesn't necessarily solve any problems from the point of view of being able to individually deploy these services, because typically their message structure becomes coupled, you end up needing to deploy a sequence of these at a time. So we've moved as much as possible towards message-based architectures. So wherever we can offload something onto a message queue that further down the line will get processed essentially asynchronously, we prefer to go that approach. There are certain situations where we still have the need to do a request response type communication between the services. You know, we have to, we've broken up the reporting suite, for example, has a querying layer that knows how to work with Elasticsearch and build up dynamic queries against what is many terabytes of data there now. And we have a sort of higher level abstraction, which is the layer that works over the reporting controls for the users to actually interact with. And those two do kind of end up coupled, because when you want to actually run a report, it has to fire off a request through the query API and wait for the response before it can return it to the user. So today that's HTTP and sort of regular REST-based APIs. The area that I'm starting to experiment with and explore is looking at gRPC, which is not a super new technology, but is quite new to the sort of .NET stack in that Microsoft have made it a first-party sort of web project that you can build now in ASP.NET Core 3.0. And so we've been starting to explore what the possibilities are with bringing gRPC in.
How has using that event based messaging sort of paradigm shift, how has that sort of changed the way you solve, where you're having to think about problems and changing problems? And maybe this kind of also ties into some of the like breaking things up into smaller pieces.
Yeah, I think when you start thinking about what can be offloaded as an asynchronous sort of piece of processing, you do start to define boundaries within your application. So we've typically gone, does this thing that we're doing at the moment need to happen immediately to be able to return a reasonable response to the user? Do we need to be able to actually run this big piece of code, or could we just eventually come back to them and say this has been done, either via some notifications such as email or possibly even in browser sort of pop-ups and notifications? And which pieces can we just sort of say, yeah, we're doing this, and take that offline? So we're trying to sort of work at the moment on defining those features. For example, sort of in the reporting suite, obviously things like being able to download report data is quite key for customers, but that doesn't necessarily have to happen on the click of a browser button and they have to sit there and wait for it to churn and send them the data. We fire that message into a queue. We have a processing service that picks those messages up, goes and runs their appropriate report, forms it into whatever output we need to provide for them, probably XML or maybe CSV. And then we just send them a download link when that's ready to go. And so that's kind of helped us split that part of the application up quite nicely, because we can see, well, okay, we've got this whole sort of domain, which is around scheduling of reports. And then we have the kind of report runners in the background that just fire off as messages come in. And one of the other nice advantages of that flow is that it means we can now independently scale all of these elements. You know, if the scheduling services are under load, but they're usually under load maybe on a Monday at 5 a.m. in the morning, preparing the weekly reports that people are waiting for, probably when they come in at 9 a.m. But that's its busy time. So we scale those services up based on queue volumes and just have as many as we need to churn through the workload. The rest of the day, they can scale back down. And you know, over weekends, we may scale down to zero because no one's hopefully running too many reports. They're enjoying their weekends at home. And that has given us a real degree of a sort of flexibility on really how we think about using the compute that we're running these things on top of.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned gRPC. It's a term that's been floating around lately. Is it just RPC from way back before SOAP, or is there something special about it? What is gRPC?
So there are some definite similarities to what people may be familiar with. There may be some people that sort of hear sort of RPC and immediately fear where we're heading with that. A lot of people have got some bad memories of working with different platforms and frameworks over time. It is very much RPC in the sense that you are writing some code that's essentially looks like you're calling a method, but it's executing on some other device or some other process elsewhere. The difference is that it's been essentially designed to fit nicely or more nicely with the HTTP model under the hood. And in fact, it actually works on top of HTTP2 specifically. And so headers are used for transferring metadata, including potentially trailing headers for information about how the RPC call went behind the scenes and what it actually achieved. But it has the common sort of features of code generation, which some people may like, others may not, but you can have a contract, you define it upfront in terms of the types of methods that you want to be available and the message structure that you want to send. That will then allow you to generate your server code and your client code. And from the client, calling through to those gRPC methods is actually pretty straightforward. You bring in the appropriate libraries, bring in the proto file, which is the protocol buffer's specification of what your service will look like. And that will generate the code that means you can just basically say, you know, get weather forecast or get report. And that will handle all of the serialization of those messages, the transmission over HTTP2, and then all of the work on the other end to sort of produce the response and send it back over the wire is kind of handled seamlessly for you. It was released in 2016 by Google, and there has been a .NET client, I think, pretty much from the beginning. But what the Microsoft team have done more recently is kind of try to make it fit in a more sort of idiomatic C# world on top of things like the Kestrel web server. So it can run natively now as part of ASP.NET Core. You can just bring in your gRPC service and have that sitting nicely on top of the speed benefits that we get with Kestrel today. And then from your client-side code, there's libraries that fit nicely into sort of HTTP client, and you can easily make your requests over that HTTP connection. So we've been sort of exploring it just to sort of see what are the benefits, what are the pros and cons. And one of the two things that we've particularly liked is actually that contract file. So although we are mostly a .NET shop, we do have now front-end teams that are typically building front-ends for back-ends that are Node applications. And something we found ourselves doing quite often is having to have these communications between teams of, okay, we're going to change the model, particularly as we're in the early phases of this breaking the monolith. What we think we need to send over the wire to one another changes daily, even weekly. And having to kind of keep those models in sync is a bit of a pain. And then obviously the code around those models has to change too. With gRPC, because we have that proto file, both teams can consume that. There's Node libraries that can read those proto files and do Node and JavaScript code generation for you, just the same as we can do on the .NET side. But it means that keeping those models in sync should in theory be a bit easier, and we can iterate quite quickly with less boilerplate code that we have to write. And for us, the second real advantage is around the performance side of things. And we haven't put any of this into production yet. We're sort of prototyping this locally. But we're certainly seeing that the payloads across the wire are about half the size they were before, maybe even more. And we can get sort of 2 or 3 times speed improvements sending those messages, because gRPC is based on a binary serialization format.
Yeah, I've been really impressed with the tooling that's come out in the generation for the proto files and spinning up the server and the client and the availability for a variety of different programming languages. It seems like that's key to getting the adoption and the buy-in from the community is producing that tooling, the documentation, and making the bar to entry so very low.
I think so, and I think that's what we're seeing. I think with ASP.NET Core 3.0, one of the key pieces of work has been around this is making gRPC a practical and realistic option for .NET developers. As I say, the libraries have been there for some time. If you wanted to kind of pull those libraries in and use them in your projects, you were able to build gRPC clients and servers, but there was a lot more that you would have to do, heavy lifting that you would have to do to set that up and potentially wire that into your web servers and things like that. And the need for the HTTP2 support is obviously a dependency there as well, which the team have been able to bring in line with Kestrel and changes to HTTP client to support that moving forward. So it's definitely something that I think now is open to a lot more developers to explore. There are challenges, I think, around the deployment side, which is part of the reason we haven't got to production with it yet. It does require that you have, you know, a HTTP2 from sort of client to server, working through the appropriate load balancing solutions. And as I say, we're running everything in AWS. So to date, the story for deploying gRPC there has been a little complex. And I know the teams there are working on sort of trying to bring it into their AppMesh product and hopefully into sort of their load balancers on top of container services, which is where we're deployed today, which I think will make the sort of moving to production story easier. But Microsoft have done a lot of the work in terms of the developer side of the story.
So for someone who's not really familiar with gRPC, like myself, why would I use it, or why might I not use it over something like a REST endpoint? You kind of mentioned the contract, so as being a pro, and then also you were saying that you have some additional performance. Are there reasons why I shouldn't just automatically go with?
Yeah, I think in terms of sort of where you might want to apply this, I would say it's a technology that looks very interesting to us, but we wouldn't go back and retrospectively destroy all of the REST endpoints we have today. Partly there's the work, you know, if these things are working and functioning, unless the performance is a real key gain for people, we wouldn't necessarily sort of jump there. But certainly within our reporting product, we have scenarios where it would be quite nice to potentially do more real-time data all the way through as events come in. So today everything's kind of, you build your report, you run your report, you have your data. But with things like gRPC, one of its other distinguishing features over sort of traditional REST is that it supports natively client and or server streaming. So you can stream messages and data from your clients to the server, which it will then just process as it receives them. But more interestingly for us would be the kind of server streaming scenarios where we could have the server continually streaming down updated data potentially to the front-end application. And then if we were to use a client-side WebSockets type technology, we could then get that data all the way down into the browser. And I think those are the scenarios where perhaps it's probably somewhere to consider it first. If you've got scenarios where you want to do real-time or you want to do sort of regular data updates, that could be a good sort of starting point for where you'd bring it in. I think from our perspective, if the production story was a bit simpler, perhaps we'd be more keen to build everything that way. But for now, we're kind of just looking at distinct endpoints that we can see where there's either high volumes of data and we can get the sort of compression and reduced size benefits, or we can look at those streaming type scenarios.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense to me.
So speaking about the production scenario, if I was a developer on a team and we were about to start some new greenfield project, should I really be looking into RPC right now? Or is there still some work maybe on the like an Amazon or Azure that needs to be done before I should really dive in?
I think depending on where you're deployed, it may still be just that bit too early. It certainly, for our point of view, feels like we need, in our case, AWS, but I'm sure it's similar for people in Azure. We need the deployment story to be very consistent and reliable and fairly easy to understand. That said, for us, we have sort of seen that this looks like a technology that's definitely progressing, and the cloud providers do seem to be definitely moving towards the support needed to set up load balancers that can support this kind of HTTP2 from sort of end to end. And so we saw that as a good sort of prompt to at least explore the technology. So we started with a couple of small sort of internal prototypes for services we were considering building. And my next step really is to also look at some existing endpoints we have today. And the nice thing is we can run HTTP REST endpoints alongside gRPC. So we can put in a gRPC endpoint that's mimicking something we have today, run them if we want to on the same Kestrel web server. And we could then start to try shifting a little bit of traffic over to call into the RPC version and see, yeah, is it giving us the throughput we're expecting? Is it giving everything we want from gRPC? But it feels like Microsoft have definitely sort of done the big push, a huge investment, I think, in terms of the time they put into the technology. I think that's already made the story a lot more promising for .NET developers in that it is now much better documented. It's built in on top of what we sort of work with day to day already. If the production side felt a little bit more mature, which I think probably in the next few months, we will start to see things roll out that will make life easier as it becomes technology people really are trying to push.
If I did go with REST endpoints for now, you said something about running them side by side. Is it relatively easy to convert a REST endpoint to gRPC later if the production story does become better?
So it's not sort of necessarily that's something that you would convert one to the other. But what you would typically look to do is to build up that proto file from your message structure and the signature essentially of the methods that you would want to be able to call. And then within Kestrel, you can just add the gRPC service to be served. And it handles the endpoints essentially for you. So the paths and the routing is all kind of managed for you seamlessly under the hood. So you can have your existing REST endpoint still sitting in that application and processing as it did before. Mark Gravel from Stack Overflow has got some protobuf .NET libraries, which he's working to support essentially code-first concept around gRPC. So his approach with that is that you would add attributes to your model classes that will allow the library to understand how you would want those serialized using protobuf. One of the key features of protobuf is that you don't actually send, say, property names over the wire. You just send integer identifiers for the data that's going across. So one of the things you do in that serialization process is identify what each property is going to be numbered, so that on both ends, as long as you've got that proto file, you can translate the data that you're receiving. But with that library, you can add those attributes onto your model classes and have it, if you want to, generate the proto file for you. So that would be certainly a starting point. And I've sort of seen discussions around sort of where they can take that in terms of making it much easier to transition projects from one to the other.
Are there any security concerns or any performance concerns with the streaming of data if we were to look into doing full-scale public-facing websites? And is there anything to be aware of that, you know, a lot of us probably have a large amount of experience writing RESTful services?
Yeah, actually, it's a really good question, because where I see this working most easily is for back-end service-to-service communication inside our microservices environment. Something we haven't considered yet is whether we would potentially expose gRPC services out to sort of external customers, perhaps, to work with, because there are some additional challenges there about how you would architect those, how you would distribute your proto files and kind of keep that process working. Certainly on the security side, with the integrations the .NET team have done, on top of Kestrel, the authentication story is pretty much what you know today. So the same authentication middleware can run in front of your gRPC services, and you can use sort of the same sort of concepts, either attributes or code additions, to identify which of those can run under, say, perhaps a certain role or a certain set of claims that have access to operate on those. But yeah, certainly I think for us, the starting point would be microservice to microservice communication rather than end client to service communication. Because then we're within that sort of safety net of our own VPC, and we can sort of tie things down and lock things down within the sort of AWS environment, as well as just the web services themselves.
Are there any resources that you would point people to who are looking to get started with gRPC, or maybe even, we talked about kind of even higher level microservices, breaking things down from the monolith and working with microservices. Where would you direct people?
So Microsoft Docs is getting really good these days, so docs.microsoft.com. I know with the release of 3.0 of .NET Core, a lot of the gRPC documentation went live at the same time. So that's there if you want to kind of just start from a sort of ground zero of how do I get my first project and how do I define the proto file and those kind of things. If you're looking for something a bit deeper around both gRPC and microservices, the free eBooks that Microsoft now have online, also accessible through sort of docs.microsoft.com, do go a lot deeper. So I know they've got their eShop for containers sample application and their microservices sort of architecture practice guide, which is really good and in-depth and realistic. And alongside that now, there's a new eBook by Mark Rendell, which is the gRPC for WCF developers, I think it is, which initially is focusing on the question of, okay, you've got a WCF application today. How would you look at porting slash migrating that over to gRPC, which is pretty much the path Microsoft are now pushing as the kind of future of those kind of services. Both of those resources are very good. I know there's some stuff due out on Pluralsight soon on gRPC. Sean Mildermuth is working on a course there. So I expect that will be a very good starting point for people with access to Pluralsight. I've done a number of blog posts as I've gone through as well. So I've kind of tried to break it down into the logical chunks that I was trying to understand as I went through. So starting with, yeah, just building the sort of Hello World gRPC application through to starting to experiment with some streaming. So people are welcome to kind of check those out as well. But I think it is still quite new out there. So you're sort of, there are some good blog posts on gRPC, but there's not a huge wealth of experience, I guess, with a sort of the problem I'm facing, really, that we're not yet in production with some of these things. And I guess everyone's a little bit sort of waiting for people to tackle those problems and share their experiences before they're too keen to dive in at the deep end, I think.
Very cool. So going to kind of close in another direction, one of the things we ask all the guests who come on is to speak a little bit directly to the listeners who might be just getting started or are trying to level up in their career. What words of wisdom or advice would you give to those people directly, just generally speaking?
I guess I'd talk about two key points. So for me, the thing that's allowed me to sort of rapidly ramp up my skills over the last 4 years, sort of coming from a self-taught developer background for the last 15 odd, where it was just me building code pretty much however I felt was the right way to do it. And basically if it worked, it was done, is really focus on continual learning. So don't be ashamed to ask questions. And often asking questions, you will find that you prompt other people to sort of explore their own boundaries of what they know about a subject as well. But focus on continual learning in any way that suits you. So for me, I pretty much a sort of multi-platform learner. I watch videos either on YouTube or Pluralsight. I read books. I read blog posts quite often, but I also like listening to podcasts like this where you can kind of just get sort of by osmosis bit more information drip fed to you on your daily commute, things like that. And in a slightly related note, I would urge people to spend a lot of time reading code. That's one of the areas where I've focused a lot of time over the last few years is digging into GitHub repositories, particularly at the deep end, looking at CoreFX, which is the .NET framework itself, .NET Core. Find some areas that you're interested in, how they work, and then try and read their code and understand what they're doing and how they're doing it. Because by looking at a very mature code base or a very deep code base like that, you'll typically, again, almost by osmosis, learn various techniques for how to structure that code and how to sort of improve your coding standards generally. And those kind of things have helped me over the last 4 years quite dramatically to ramp up my tech skills.
So I know you've mentioned your blog posting. Are there any other social media or places where your listeners could come and follow you to find out more of what you're doing and hear more from you?
Yeah, so the main place I'm reasonably active, either tweeting about ASP.NET, .NET, or GIN, is on Twitter. So I'm at Steve J. Gordon there. And I've pretty much tried to be Steve J. Gordon wherever I can be, because Twitter's kind of dictated my username across the web. So I'm also Steve J. Gordon on GitHub. I've got a number of sample repos there if people want to kind of dive into quick starts and things like gRPC and some stuff around high performance code that I've been doing. I think I'm also Steve J. Gordon on YouTube, but the easiest way to get to me there, where I've got some older content now, is just to go through my blog. So stevejgordon.co.uk. And there's some links off from there to my YouTube content and also Pluralsight courses, things like that.
And finally, do you have any upcoming speaking engagements?
So it's been a really busy end of the year. It's as we move into end of November, I'm quite pleased that I get a month or so off. And then things ramp back up again with NDC London in January. And then I'm off to Montreal, I think, in February for Confu. So I'm really excited to actually have my first opportunity to speak over the Atlantic, having done just sort of UK and Europe so far. Then I think there's a bunch of things lining up for March onwards. I think I'm at Rock Sharp in Poland in March, and then a few other things starting to fall into place and call for papers being submitted. So hopefully a number of other places next year as well.
All right. Excellent. Well, thanks, Steve. Really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today.
Great. Thank you for having me.
That was Steve Gordon. Steve is a Pluralsight author, Microsoft MVP, senior developer and community lead based in Brighton, UK.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
And be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential. I am John Calloway.
I am Clayton Hunt.
And I am John Ash.